Welcome to the Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's National Agenda Series, Direction Democracy, which examines where we've been, where we're going, and the current state of democracy in the United States. I'm your host, Tom Byrne, News Director at Delaware Public Media. On this episode, we are joined, as always, by the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman. Thanks for being with us again.
Sure thing.
And we're also happy to have on this episode the CPC's Research Director, Paul Brewer. How are you?
Doing fine. Great to be back.
All right. Well, since we have you here, Paul, and you are kind of our designated polling guru, let's start with that. And specifically, all this polling we're kind of consistently seeing through this early stage of the presidential race. We see national polls on the Democratic primary, state polls on the Democratic primaries, Trump versus possible opponent polls nationally and at the state level, and some variations on the questions being asked about whether it's favorability or electability. So having kind of looked at all of that, what is it worth taking away from all this data that's being kind of thrown out there for people, and what if anything, are we learning from it?
All right, well, can I start with a confession? So I'm going to use my starting point, the Democratic debate last week, which I actually didn't watch because I was playing Dungeons and Dragons with friends. So I'm a really bad political scientist and polling expert.
I was live tweeting that debate.
Yeah. So you're
carrying the weight.
You have the high ground. But what I have been doing since then is following what's been happening with the polls and the news coverage after the debate. And so a few patterns here and a few kind of thoughts on what we should and shouldn't attach to these polling results. One is that there hasn't been a lot of movement, dramatic movement in the polls since the debate. Compared to the first debate, not as many people watched it. And in terms of media coverage, you know, there was some coverage about Biden's age, and maybe we can talk about that as an issue going forward, and the dust-up between him and Julian Castro. But not a huge number of clear storylines coming out of that debate. And you see that reflected in the polls. Biden is really, in the polls that have come out, and there haven't been that many, but there have been now high-quality ones are starting to come out. Biden seems to have stayed the same, so he's still in the lead, maybe about 30 percentage points on average. Warren has been, so Warren's campaign had a kind of a rocky start, a rocky rollout, but since then she's been steadily climbing in the polls. She has a very, you know, consistent, clear, progressive message. So she's positioning herself as she's to the left of Biden. You know, she's more, I'm going to break up the banks. We're going to push things further with health care than the Obama-Biden administration did. So pretty clear message. And she's been steadily climbing. It hasn't been a big jump, no big drops. And so she's at the point now where she's starting to pull away a little bit, it looks like, from Bernie Sanders, who's in third place in the polls. And in December 2016, I was telling everyone, keep an eye on Kamala Harris. So, you know, and so after the first debate, I was like, hey, see, I told you. But since then, things have not really gone very well for her. And she's dropped quite a bit. Now she's down with Pete Buttigieg, who's climbed maybe just a little bit. And everyone else is further back. Bill de Blasio, there's a story about how he was polling at 0% in New York City. Mm-hmm. Maybe coincidentally, maybe not, he dropped out.
Well, I was thinking too, you know, on our last podcast, I was kind of bemoaning the state of public opinion polling and that there's just too many polls. And I was thinking, you bring up Elizabeth Warren, crowd size seems to be a discussion now for some kind of indicator of you know, this favorability, electability, whatever it might be. But that seems to be the big storyline with her events, is how many people were there. And more importantly, how many people were in the selfie line. That's, I guess, her new thing.
Yeah, so this has been a story over the past week. And, you know, professional pollsters sort of roll their eyes at the crowd size stories because it's very unscientific. So she had a crowd of 20,000 in New York City. Well, okay, New York City. There's a lot of people in New York City that can go. And you know, less reported, apparently Kamala Harris had a similar crowd size in Oakland, which is a smaller city, but in her home state. How do you interpret that?
Right.
But I think maybe one of the reasons that the Warren crowd size stories are getting attention is that there's the polls suggest that there might be something to that, and that her support is enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. She has higher enthusiastic ratings than some of the other candidates do. She's also a lot of people's second choice. So, and the polling in Iowa that's come out recently, you know, definitely would want to keep an eye on that and see what happens with the Des Moines Register's coming out with the poll at some point in the near future, which which could be pretty revealing. But she looks like she's doing quite strongly in Iowa, whereas Sanders is not doing as well.
I wonder if we should do an analysis of like the chants at these events, because Warren's supporters are chanting things like 2 cents, 2 cents, like chant about tax policy, which is kind of surprising.
I want to ask kind of a curveballish question about Joe Biden's numbers, because my recollection from the last presidential cycle was the one thing that people kept saying about Trump was that his number was just kind of like consistent. His number just is consistent. Are we seeing kind of the same thing with Joe Biden, that there's just this kind of consistency? Is this like maybe the one thing that Joe Biden and Donald Trump have in common is they have this like very solid foundation that they kind of just kind of ride through whatever storm they happen to wander into?
Well, I think that goes back to the age issue that Paul brought up. I mean, they've just been around for so long. People have established viewpoints about them. And I think when you have that kind of longevity, you're not really changing opinions very much.
Yeah, the polls I've seen suggest that a lot of Democratic voters, they may have a top candidate, but they're very willing to change their minds. So there is a potential fluidity in these numbers. Biden is the best known. Sanders is very well known, too. So you might look at them and say, maybe there's less room to grow. Warren is fairly well known, but not quite as well known. Right. So people who are starting to tune in, there might be room for her to appeal to them. And some of the other candidates are less well known, but at this point, you know, they have to start wondering, am I ever going to be well known? Because it's not the early campaign anymore.
Yeah, and before we start getting into that a little bit and a little bit more about the age issue you both have brought up, since we have you here, Paul, I did want to ask you something that Lindsay and I kind of delved into a little bit in the last podcast, and which is that, you know, these polls are now, you know, a big part of deciding who winds up on the debate stage in each of these debates. And is that a good idea or is that not a good idea? And, you know, do you sense that maybe that changes how candidates approach things, knowing that, you know, maybe in the past it was all like, you've got to be in Iowa all the time, you've got to be in New Hampshire all the time. Now you got to kind of do that and keep that national presence, be on cable news shows and things like that to make sure that, like, in the national polls, people know who you are.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, because the DNC criteria, you can qualify on the polling thresholds in either national polls or in early state polls. And so the way to game that system, I think, is that you get more bang for your buck by advertising heavily in early states, which is the strategy that the Steyer campaign seems to have taken. So they've spent a huge amount of money on advertisements and publicity in states like New Hampshire. When he got his qualifying polls, they weren't in national polls because he has no national polling profile.
Right.
It was in these state polls where it's easier to spend the same amount of money, but reach a bigger percentage.
You can move the needle
a little
bit more easily.
Exactly.
Interesting. The other thing I wanted to ask you is just about, you know, we kind of almost always hear in these stories mainly about who's up, who's down, that type of thing, the horse race type of aspect. Is it maybe more interesting to look at what other data we get out of these polls at this point and what insight they might give us about voters, who's voting, what they care about? Is that maybe perhaps more informative at this juncture in the race than trying to figure out who's winning and losing?
Yeah, so in terms of who's winning and losing, I do think that sometimes news coverage, and, you know, myself included, obviously, because I'm talking about this, emphasizes the horse race aspects too much. I think at this stage you can learn some things. So candidates who are going nowhere in the polls are very, very unlikely to become the nominee. Candidates who are in positions like Biden's or Warren's, we know based on track record, have a fairly high probability of getting the nomination. I would say that there are some polls that do get too much attention, and that is general election horse race polls at this point. Mm-hmm. Like, how does Biden do against Trump versus how does Warren do against Trump? That's not meaningful. One, because we're very far out from the November election. And two, it's apples and oranges comparison because Biden might be better known than some of the other candidates. So it's capturing not just potential vote choice, but also name recognition, which is by November 2020, everybody will know who the Democrat nominee is. So it's not really capturing the competitive nature.
If I can bring something anecdotal into the conversation, this just reminded me of I was with my National Agenda students this week, and they just started writing their blogs, and I have never really seen such a common thread among all of them, which was that they're tired of this kind of strategic game frame. And they keep saying, you know, one student listed, I think she said she pulled up her, you know, she gets news in the morning, she pulled up 10 articles. In each of the headlines, it was somebody brawls, somebody pits against someone else, someone is, you know, in at war or, you know, combat, battle. And I think that this generation, Generation Z, I think they're looking for something substantively different from candidates. So again, we're talking about age, but I think that they're not going to respond necessarily to that kind of horse race coverage that I think older generations do.
But to get back to Tom's question, I think, and in building on what you're saying, I think you can get more insights into these polls. For example, looking at where candidates stand on the issues and what the public thinks about that. For example, Democratic voters seem to see Sanders as further on the left than Warren. You know, you could argue on a lot of policy positions they're quite similar, but I think perhaps that reflects the perception that Warren is more of a work within the system, Sanders is a more burn it to the ground kind of candidate, and that's reflected in what potential voters think.
Mm-hmm.
Since you brought it up, this kind of like shaking out of the candidates and when kind of the pecking order at this point, you know, after this last debate, it does maybe feel like it's kind of falling into tiers. The top one, as you mentioned, the kind of Biden, Warren, Sanders one, perhaps Buttigieg, Harris in the middle, and stealing from the original Gilligan's Island theme song, the "And the Rest" crew. Is that a fair read of the race? And if so, you know, what does that tell us? Is there maybe a candidate who can, like the professor and Mary Ann, eventually get into the theme song with their actual name instead of being part of "And the Rest"?
It is possible, and this campaign reminds me sort of the 2004 Democratic campaign, where it was really kind of hard to think. You know, you had Howard Dean, you had John Kerry.
Yeah. Remember when that was enough to get you kicked out?
Okay, so since you brought that up, this is a little bit of a tangent, but this is the thing with crowd size. So sometimes media coverage focuses on moments like that. But what I like to remind people about the Dean scream, so for those of you listening who don't remember this, so after the Iowa caucuses, when Dean came in, unexpected poor showing of third place, I think it was, he gave this speech. He was trying to rally his supporters, and he ended it with a scream. Maybe it sounded kind of funny because of the audio quality.
Mm-hmm. Right. It was a little overmodulated, as we like to say.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so you know the technical term. But the deal was that became – so I ask students these days, so what do you – Howard Dean? And the only thing they remember about Howard Dean is,
yeah. Yep.
And the way they tell it is, he gave the scream and he lost, but it's the other way around. He lost, then he gave the scream, and then that becomes the storyline about why he lost. He was a hothead who screamed.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a reflection of events that already happened. That was the moment that we used to encapsulate what happened, but that wasn't what brought him to that point.
But I see your point though. Like we had Kerry, we had Dean. There wasn't a clear front runner in 2004.
Exactly. Like 2016, you know, Hillary Clinton was a clear front runner, and then Bernie Sanders was a clear challenger.
Right. And I guess one of the things that you're seeing a lot of people kind of starting to kind of talk a little bit about is Buttigieg is maybe pivoting to be the backup Biden, that he's, you know, if Biden falters, there's a problem that he's trying to find that moderate lane where he can, you know, he's going to be the one who can kind of stand as a contrast to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Does it feel like that might be a thing as well?
Yeah, I think pundits and folks like us like to talk about lanes. Mm-hmm. And one thing we see from the polling is that the lanes aren't necessarily as clear as the common narrative might have them. So you might think, so there's this progressive lane and it's Warren and Sanders duking it out for that. But in reality, a lot of Biden supporters have Sanders as a second choice and a lot of Sanders supporters have a Biden. Yeah, and voters don't necessarily see the ideology and the policy in the same way that insiders maybe see it.
I do want to get to the age question, and the reason I'm bringing it up now is because if you look at that top tier, it tends to skew older, right? I mean, and does that say anything to us about where voters are at? We've talked in the previous podcast about kind of like Joe Biden as like the comfort food candidate that like we feel okay, you know, we think he can win and we know he can kind of get things back to normal. And the reason I brought this up is we have this like top tier that seems to skew older. Yet at the same time, we have former President Jimmy Carter saying like, yeah, maybe there should be an age limit on when you can run. Like, you know, he couldn't see himself at age 80, like being president. So, Is there a point where maybe that does become kind of a factor with people, particularly if people maybe start talking about it less like Julian Castro did in kind of a snarky way and more in a President Carter way, like kind of like thoughtfully, like, I'm not sure this is a great idea way.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, I'm going to bring it back to sort of Generation Z and how they're responding differently to candidates. I mean, I think that, you know, as always, older generations are voting at much greater rates than younger generations. But as we see that change, and if I might, I'd like to talk a little bit about some data that we just got recently. But as we see that change, as we saw in 2018 in the midterms, where young people are voting at far higher rates than in previous years, we might see a shift towards wanting younger candidates. So I don't know. It's we might be only tapping into older people right now. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky question to talk about, because if you criticize a candidate on age, it opens you up to, is this an example of ageism?
Mm.
And there's discussions now, should candidates over a certain age, you know, release their medical records? And I believe Biden has said that he's going to.
Sure, yeah.
I think back in the 1980s, there's a lot of discussion about age in Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And in his first debate performance, he gave a very uninspiring debate performance, and that fueled speculation. Of course, famously, he had this one-liner in the second debate with Walter Mondale, where he said that he wasn't going to make age an issue. He wasn't going to take advantage of his youth and inexperience. And in interviews afterwards, Mondale said that he knew that he knew that that was when he lost the race.
Wow.
That was over.
Yeah, and we saw that even locally here, you know, when Tom Carper ran against Bill Roth. Again, there was a lot of talk about Bill Roth's age at that point. Tom Carper, you know, kind of stayed away from it as something he would explicitly talk about. But at one point, Bill Roth kind of had a moment where he stumbled at an event, and kind of the issue kind of just took over that way. So with the opposition didn't have to make the case. The kind of case was made for them. But it was kind of always there, just waiting for that moment that sometimes just turns the tide.
Yeah, which brings me back to Castro, because so what Mondale said in that interview also was that he wanted to let the media bring up that issue, because if he brought it up, that people would perceive him as mean.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so Castro brought it up, or at least a lot of people perceived that he did.
Right.
And so it brought the issue out then. There's a conversation about it. Did bringing it up Castro, if you look at the polls and you look at the coverage that Castro got, I don't think it helped him. It might have helped the field, but you know, Castro got...
He didn't directly benefit from it.
He didn't directly. So one of his endorsers unendorsed him.
Yeah, and switched to Biden, actually.
Switched to Biden.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's age is a sensitive topic, but I mean, I think what I'm noticing, and again, I keep coming back to Generation Z, it's because I'm teaching these students, we're teaching these students, but I'm seeing this real sea change in activism among youth, particularly around issues like climate change. I read something the other day that about 1 in 4 people under the age of 18, not eligible to vote yet, have taken some sort of action towards climate change, like a school walkout or a protest or something like this. And I feel like that's really remarkable. And I think that if young people are going to continue to participate at this rate, they're going to be expecting people to look more like them. So if I can do a little drum roll.
No, so I want to get to what you want to talk about. And this is probably a good spot to jump into that, about this kind of this discussion of engagement on college campuses. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the University of Delaware is part of an initiative called the National Study of Learning, Voting, and Engagement out of Tufts University. So they measure student voting rates at over 1,000 different campuses. And they just released the data. We've been waiting with bated breath for these data, because a lot of us thought, I think we did a better job in 2018. I think more students voted and were registered. We, on this campus, started using TurboVote, which is an online registration app. So it makes it a lot easier for students to get engaged. So I will release the data officially. Thank you. In 2014, the voting rate at the University of Delaware among students was 14.8%. So just under 15% in 2014. Any guesses as to what that number was in 2018?
I'm not going to say you told me earlier.
I can see your computer.
All right. It was 41.6%. 41.6% of University of Delaware students voted in the 2018 midterms. That's an increase of almost 27%. I am really delighted by this information. The other thing I'm noticing in the patterns here is that a lot of that increase comes from absentee voting. So TurboVote and online programs, I think, can really help students who are from out of state. That's one of the primary complaints we get from students is they don't know how to submit their absentee ballots. So I'm very proud of our University of Delaware students. It'll be really interesting to see what happens in 2020, if we'll see this pattern sustain or if there will be, you know, less interest. And it'll be interesting to see if it sustains into the next midterms as well.
And you and I talked earlier about this. I mean, does this, when you talk about the absentee piece of this, show that there is some effectiveness to making it easier to vote absentee? Like, a lot of states have gone that route of making it a little bit easier, you know, breaking down some of the barriers to voting absentee. And is this an indication that that is actually having a real life impact?
Well, these numbers, it suggests so, yeah. And I mean, the increase in voting is mostly among young people and among absentee. So in 2014, only 10% of 18 to 21 year old students voted. So these are, you know, we have students of all different ages. But in 2018, that was 37%. So it's just a phenomenal change. It's really a sea change. And when it comes to talking about age and generations, I do think that this generation is going to demand activists that look more like them, like the Parkland survivors, like Greta Thunberg, mm-hmm. if I'm getting her name correctly, the climate activist who's 16 years old. So I think that's something to keep an eye on.
Well, and it takes me right to where I want to go next, which is something local, which is we are seeing some earlier announcers in state legislative races here in Delaware, particularly on the Democratic side. Some of the key ones are in Newcastle County, Sarah McBride, who's looking to take over Harris McDowell's state Senate seat when he retires next year, Kyle Evans-Gay challenging incumbent Republican Kathy Cloutier, and Medina Wilson-Anton primary incumbent Democrat state representative, so a Democratic primary, John Viola. McBride, transgender, Kyle Evans-Gay, a woman, Wilson-Anton, a Muslim woman. They all skew younger. What does that say about this move to what you're saying, maybe younger, more diverse, that we did see a little bit in the last cycle here in Delaware,
sure.
where there was definitely an uptick in people of color and women getting elected in this state. Do we feel like this is, we are starting to see, even though they're just running, they haven't been elected, but there seems to be more interest in that type of candidate saying, yeah, I can do this, I can run now.
I think the midterms in 2018 really demonstrated that candidates like Ocasio-Cortez and sort of these younger, less experienced, or even if they are politically experienced, but just kind of the lesser known candidates are actually can win. And I think that that has motivated people like Sarah and like other folks to say, you know, if they can do it, maybe I can do it.
And not like the kind of, you know, wait your turnism, right? I mean, like
right.
that maybe they, as you know, Paul, you were mentioning before we started, like, you know, most of these candidates who are running, they have some kind of political connection. They're not political neophytes, but maybe in previous cycles, it had been like, well, it's not your turn yet, you know, and maybe that seems to be kind of disappearing now.
Yeah, I think if you look at the Democratic Party and where it is and where it's going right now, it's a party that, you know, young people skew heavily towards the Democratic Party now. The party, a substantial percentage of the party supporters are people of color. LGBT voters skew heavily towards the Democratic Party. The party is majority women by a pretty clear margin. And so, you know, I think we're starting to see candidates who look like the party voters themselves. And so I think that's a powerful force. You saw it reflected nationally in 2018. You're seeing it in these candidates announcing in Delaware. And I think that's a reflection of what the party looks like. So I think, you know, you could see that as a healthy development if you believe that who the party puts forward in terms of candidates should reflect who the party's supporters look like.
All right. Well, let's wrap up as we always do with our political quick take, your hot quick take, your quick hot take, whatever you want to look at it as. So who wants to go first? Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, flip a coin.
I'll go first. All
right, Lindsay, you're up.
Well, another thing that came up from my students that I wanted to bring up in this section is a metaphor that seems to have really caught their attention. So I'm going to get a little academic here. We know that the mind is generally divided into two parts. I'm not talking about the left brain and the right brain, but I'm talking about how we process information and how we think about things. In psychology and communication, we often teach about central processing and peripheral processing, basically paying close attention to something or just sort of letting information come in without really paying much attention to it. Economist Daniel Kahneman also talks about these two systems in the book Thinking Fast and Slow. So we have this fast automatic system, and the system two is more slow and effortful. The book that my students are reading in National Agenda is called The Righteous Mind by moral psychologist Jonathan Haidt. And he creates this metaphor of the elephant and the rider. And my students seem really perplexed and also taken with this metaphor, that basically the rider is your rationality, like the central route. The elephant is your affect or emotion. And think of how large an elephant is compared to a human being. Emotions are really powerful. And what my students are learning is that if you want to persuade a person to believe what you believe or vote for the person you want to vote for, you really need to appeal to their emotions, that reasons aren't the best route for changing someone's mind. So I think they're really having a lot of fun with that metaphor. So I thought I'd make that my quick take.
So we've been talking about age and the age issue and generations in politics. And so at the national level and in Delaware, we're starting to see this new wave of candidates for public office who are millennials. And maybe even some post-millennials if we're starting to talk about candidates who are 25 years old. And so getting back to the presidential campaign, I was wondering whether there was a possibility that this time around there would actually be a nominee from the generation that I belong to, Generation X.
I was going to bring that up. There has never been a Gen X president.
There's never been a Gen X presidential nominee. Mm-hmm. And so you have some Gen Xers in the Democratic field. You've got Cory Booker, you've got Julian Castro, you've got Peter O'Rourke. Buttigieg might actually be a little young.
Yeah,
and
I think
Harris, I don't know if she's Generation X or on the fringe of the generation beyond. But so you had some...
Close enough.
I'll claim her. So you have a number of plausible candidates in the race, but it's not really breaking for any of them. The leading candidates are in their 70s. And we see this rising tide of millennial candidates. And so my new thought is that maybe that will go straight from baby boomer presidents to millennial presidents, skipping over Generation X.
A lost generation.
A lost generation, which would
we're
be...
We're always forgotten.
Which would be the most Gen X thing ever.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, there's that graph that was going around for a while that showed different generational differences and just
Chiron,
completely
yes.
forgot
so
Gen X.
So, you know, the presidency will look like that
yep.
graphic too.
Yep.
A fascinating take. Thank you very much, Lindsay Hoffman. For being with us, the UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director. We appreciate you being here.
Sure thing, thanks.
And also thanks to Paul Brewer, CPC's Research Director, for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you again next time on the University of Delaware Center for Political Communications Direction Democracy Podcast. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Direction Democracy Podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more information on the University of Delaware Center for Political Communications Direction Democracy National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu. And a reminder, the next Direction Democracy National Agenda Series event is Wednesday, October 2nd, with CNN political contributor and former GOP communications director Tara Settmeyer. That starts October 2nd at 7:30 at UD's Mitchell Hall.